Hi, this is Thelma English, and I'll be reading to you Book 11 of Virgil's Aeneid. We're reading from the Robert Fitzgerald translation. Make sure that you have your book in front of you, The Aeneid by Virgil, the Robert Fitzgerald translation, Book 11. When dawn came up from ocean in the east, though Pallas's death had left Aeneas shaken and duty pressed him to give time for burial of the dead, he first in early light discharged his ritual vows as victor to the gods. So he's very pious. The first thing he's going to do is make a vow and give a bunch of offerings to the gods in thanks for winning. A big oak trunk, lopped of its boughs, he planted on a mound and dressed it with Mezentius's bright gear to make a trophy, god of war, to thee. So he makes a trophy for Mars. He puts Mezentius, that's the really mean guy that he killed at the end of the last book, and he puts all his stuff on an oak tree like a scarecrow, offering it to Mars. He fitted it with a crest still oozing blood, with javelins of the warrior and his cuirass, his breastplate, 12 times cut and breached. On the left side he tied the bronze shield, and he slung the ivory scabbard and sword around the figure's neck. Then he addressed the officers who thronged about him in elation. So this is Aeneas talking to all his officers. One great mission stands accomplished, men. For what remains, let all our fears depart from us. I stripped these arms from a proud king, Mezentius. My offering now, first trophy in the war, Mezentius become this figure at my hands. The road before us leads to the Latin town and king. Look to your gear and courage. Think ahead with good cheer of the war to come. And when by will of the high gods our flag is raised, our troops led from the camp, nothing amiss or unforeseen will cumber or delay us. No heavy-heartedness will slow us down. Meanwhile, let us give over to the earth our friends' unburied bodies, the one honor possible for them now in Acheron. Of course, Acheron's the river in Hades. So first, before they can do anything, they have to give honor to all the dead, their dead friends. Go, he continued, and make beautiful the funeral rites for those heroic souls who won this land for us. Let Pallas first be sent to Evander's grieving town, because Pallas is the son of King Evander. He lacked no valor when the black day took him off and sank him in death's bitterness. He wept as he said this, then made his way again to his own threshold, where the corpse of Pallas lay in care of old Echoetes, once Arcadian Evander's armor-bearer, chosen under less happy auspices, less happy times, to be the companion of a cherished ward. So Echoetes used to watch over Pallas as a little ward. He was like his guardian, and now he's guardian of his body. Their household stood around with men of Troy and Trojan women, hair unbound in mourning. Then as Aeneas entered the tall doorway, everyone there groaned mightily to heaven, beating their breasts. The prince's lodge, their camp, rang out with sobs and lamentation when he saw the head at rest, the snow-white face of Pallas, the smooth chest and the open wound, the southern Italian spearhead made. His tears welled up with grim words. So this is Aeneas speaking to Pallas's body. Was it you, poor boy, that fortune would not let me keep when she came smiling? You who were not to see our kingdom won or ride in victory to your father's house? This was not the pledge I made Evander, the king your father, on your behalf on leaving him when he embraced me and gave godspeed to my quest for countrywide command. Anxiously, too, he warned of battle with a rugged race, with savage fighting men. Even at this hour, prey to false hope, he may be making vows and heaping altars with his gifts. Why? While here we gather with a soldier, young and dead, who owes no vows to heaven any longer. So your own dad might be home making vows for your safety and everything, and here you lie dead. Here is our helpless ritual and our sorrow. Father ill-fated, you will see his funeral. Can this be our return, our longed-for triumph? This my great pledge carried through? Enough. Evander, you will see no shameful wound of one who ran, hit from behind. You'll pray for no hard death because a son lives on disgraced. What a defense Ausonia lost, and you too, Aeolus. So he's saying, Evander, you're not going to be afraid of your son. His wounds are from the front, so you won't have to worry about that. And he says, when they lost Pallas, wow, what a defense they lost, what a horrible loss. And to his son, Aeolus, too, he would have been a faithful friend. Having wept his fill, line 80, he had the forlorn body taken up for journeying, and from the army chose 1,000 men to march as retinue at Pallas's funeral. These would take part in mourning with his father, for great pain, small consolation, but the poor kings do. Deft hands now made a pliant bier of wicker. Arbutus shoots and oak twigs interwoven, shading the piled-up couch with screens of leaves. Here on this rustic bed they lay the prince, most like a flower, a girl's fingers plucked, soft-petaled violet or hyacinth, with languid head, is not yet discomposed or faded, though its mother earth no longer nourishes it and makes it stand in bloom. So Pallas's body is just like a flower you pick, and it's not quite started rotting yet, it's just lost its bloom. Aeneas brought two robes, all stiff with gold, embroidery, and purple. Dido of Sidon herself had loved the toil of making these with her own hands one day for him, for Aeneas, interweaving golden thread into the fabric, line 100. One of these the sorrowing man wrapped around the prince in final honor, and he spread the other, mantling the hair soon to be set aflame. He heaped the many prizes Pallas won in the Laurentine battle, to be borne in a long file, and outed mounts and weapons taken in his own flights from the enemy. Then came, hands bound behind their backs, the prisoners he sent as offerings to the shades below. This is human sacrifice. Intending that when slain they should bedew the pyre's flames with blood, and he commanded officers themselves to carry trophies, tree trunks in foeman's gear, so with names attached. So these are like scarecrows with all their stuff on them, and they're going to carry them. Acetes had to be led, far gone in age and misery, his breast stung by his blows from hitting his breast, his cheeks torn by his nails from his torturous soul. At times he fell full length, flinging himself to earth. War cars, chariots, they also led, a glisten with Rutulian blood. The war horse Athen, bare of insignia, came behind with big tears rolling down to wet his cheeks. Then men who bore the spear and helm of Pallas for his belt and sword were held by Turnus the victorious. This is foreshadowing. So they're taking back the helmet and the spear of Pallas. They don't have his belt and sword. Turnus took those. And now the whole sad column marched, the Trojans, all the Etruscans, the Arcadians, with arms reversed, with a long file. When the long file had gone a distance on its way, Aeneas halted, sighed from the heart, and spoke a final word. So he sends Pallas's body home to his dad with 1,000 people, and he walks them a little bit of the way, and then he stops, and he's going to send them on, and he's going to go back to the fort, try to fix up the walls and get ready for battle. So he says, like a little soliloquy, line 130, "More of the same drear destiny of battle calls me back to further tears. Forever hail to you, my noble friend, my Pallas. Hail and forever farewell." That was all. Then he turned backwards toward the parapets and made his way to camp, back to camp. From the Latin city, spokesmen wearing chaplets of olive boughs had now arrived with a petition for him. Let him give back their dead. So his enemy is sending him we want peace for 12 days to bury our dead. Let him give back their dead, felled by the sword, who lay upon the field. Let him permit interment of them under an earthen mound. There was no combat with defeated men who breathe the air no longer. Let him spare them. Hosts, he called them once, and fathers-in-law. This request the good heart of Aeneas could not spurn, but granted. And he added, "What unmerited misfortune, Latins, could have embroiled you in so sad a war, that now you turn your backs on us, your friends?" So Aeneas is saying, "I can't believe you guys fought us when you made friends with us. Do you ask peace from me for those whose lives were taken off by the cast of Mars? Believe me, I should have wished to grant it to the living. Never should I have come here had not fate allotted me this land for settlement. Like, I didn't come here on my own. I had to come here. It's fate. Nor do I war upon your people. No, your king dropped our alliance, our friendship, lent himself instead to Turnus's fighting. In all fairness, Turnus should have faced death on this field. If he would end the war by force and drive the Trojans out, he should have fought me, fought my weapons. Then the one for whom great Mars or his own sword prevailed would have lived on. Go now, light fires beneath your wretched dead." He finished, line 165, and they stood stricken and still, turning their eyes to look at one another. Adrances, an aging man, forever hostile to the young Turnus. So remember that Adrances hates Turnus. Forever hostile to the young Turnus, whom he blamed and hated, spoke in reply, "Great man by fame, and proven greater in warfare, Prince of Troy, how can I match your godly nobleness with praise? Shall I admire the just man first, or first his deeds of war? Surely in gratitude we'll take your generous words back to our city. Then, fortune willing, we shall see that you and King Latinus reunite. Let Turnus look to his own alley. Our happiness will be to raise your destined bulk of wall and bear the stones of Troy upon our shoulders. So this guy that hates Turnus, this guy Drances, says, yeah, we don't have anything against you. We'll go tell Turnus to fight his own battle. We'll even carry your rocks for you to help build your new palace. To this, the rest as one man spoke assent, and so they made a 12-day truce, while peace should hold between them, Teucrians and Latins mingling without harm, as they traversed the wooden ridges. Lofty ash trees rang with strokes of double-bladed axes, pines that towered starward toppled and came down, and men with wedges all day long split oak and fragrant cedar logs, or hauled the trunks of mountain ash on groaning wains on carts. So for 12 days they're burying their dead. Rumor, already flown ahead inland, had heralded the mournful news. It filled Evander's ears, King Evander's ears, Pallas's father. His house, his city walls, rumor that only lately had reported Pallas victorious in Latium. Arcadians crowding to the gates by night took up the funeral torches custom called for, flames whose glare in a long line moved out along the road between the fields. The Phrygian, the Trojans, the thousand men, the Phrygian column came to meet and join that line of men lamenting. When the women saw them near the walls, they made the darkened town blaze up with wailing cries. As for Evander, King Evander, nothing could hold him, but he took his way amid them all to see where they set the bier, then threw himself on Pallas, on his son. Clinging there with tears and sobs, he barely spoke at last when pain abated. So this is King Evander speaking to his dead son Pallas. This you had not promised, Pallas, telling your father with what care you would go into action facing Mars. I knew how heady it could be to draw first blood, to taste the wine of victory in your first combat. That was his first combat. Manhood's bitter gain, war's hard initiation close at hand, my vows, my prayers, unheard by any god. Oh, blessed wife, so lucky in your death that she's dead already, nor kept alive to suffer this. For my part, I have outlived my time to linger on, survivor of my son. Would God, Rutulians had found me side by side with Trojan troops and pinned me to the earth with spears, I should myself have given up my life. Would God this cortege, this procession, brought me and not Pallas home? Not that I blame you or decry our compact, so Evander doesn't blame the Trojans for the death of his son. Trojans and our hand-grip guest and host, this lot awaited me in my old age. But if my son had early death before him, I can rejoice that first he took the lives of countless Volscians, that he met his end leading the Trojans into Latium. Besides, I could not wish a funeral more noble for you, Pallas, than this one. Aeneas in his piety, his religiosity, performs. With Phrygian leaders, Trojan leaders, and Etruscan captains, all the Etruscan army, men to whom your sword arm dealt out death, are here as trophies, the prisoners he took. Great ones, you too, Turnus, would stand here, a huge trunk with arms, had age and strength and seasoning of years matched him with you. But I, in my misery, why do I hold back the Trojans from the war? March on. Remember this, my message to your king. If I live out my hateful life now, Pallas gone, your sword arm keeps me, Turnus's life the debt. So Turnus has to die. Whatever happens, he says he wants them to go back and tell Aeneas, Turnus, the one who killed his son, he's got to die. You see, it owes to father as to son. In this alone your greatness and your fortune now have scope. I ask no joy in life, I may not, but to take word to my son far down amid the shades. I just want to die and go be with my son. Line 251. Dawn at that hour brought on her kindly light for ill mankind, arousing men to labor and distress. By now Aeneas and Tarchon had built up their pyres along the curving shore. On them, in the old-time ritual, each bore and placed the bodies of his men. The smoky fires caught underneath and hid the face of heaven in a tall gloom. Round pyres, as they blazed, troops harnessed in bright armor marched three times in parade formation, and the cavalry swept about the sad cremation flame three times, while calling out their desolate cries. Tears fell upon the ground, fell upon armor. High in the air rose the wild yells of men, the metal knell of trumpets. There were some who hurled gear taken from the Latin slain into the fire, helmets and ornate swords and reins and chariot wheels. Others tossed in gifts more familiar to the dead, their spears and shields, which luck had not attended. On all sides, death received burnt offerings of oxen. Throats of swine were bled into the flames, with cattle commandeered from all the fields. Then over the whole shore they stood to see their fellow soldiers burning, and kept watch on pyres as they flared. Men could not be torn from the scene till dew-drenched night came on, and a night sky studded with fiery stars. The wretched Latins, line 280, also in their quarter, built countless pyres, and of their many dead they buried some, took some inland or home into the city. All the rest they burned, heaped up in a mammoth carnage, bodies jumbled, numberless and nameless. Everywhere fields strove with field in brightness of thick fires. A third day lightened heaven of cold and gloom before the mourners raked from the deep ash scattered bones and piled warm earth upon them. So they burn the bodies and they gather up the bones. They either wrap them up to take home or they bury them in the dirt. Line 290. That day in the city, within the walls of rich Latinus, high-pitched wailing rose, the climax of long mourning. Mothers, brides bereft, and tender hearts of sisters grieving, orphaned boys, all cursed the war, the marriage hope of Turnus. Let him fight alone, they called. So they want Turnus. That's Turnus's war. Why do we all have to die if just so that Turnus can marry the girl he wants? Let him fight alone, they called, and fight it out to a decision. He who demands kingship in Italy and highest honors for himself. Then Drances, remember this is the guy who hates Turnus already, then Drances gave his weight to this, fiercely avowing Turnus alone was called to single combat. At the same time, many declared themselves in one way or another on Turnus's side. The queen's great name protected him. Renown and trophies fairly won stood in his favor. Amid these hot exchanges, as the tumult reached its height, who should arrive in gloom? One more misfortune, but the emissaries back from Diomede's city. So they had sent to Diomede's city, thinking he's a Greek, he hates Trojans, he will come help us fight, and Diomede says, no way, I'm done fighting, bearing his reply, and nothing had been gained by all their effort and expense. Their gifts, their gold, their long entreaties had not moved him. Latins must look elsewhere for reinforcement, or ask for peace terms from the Trojan prince. Now King Latinus, at this grievous blow, lost heart, for he too, for the gods' anger shown in burial mounds before his eyes, had told him Aeneas came as one ordained, brought by palpable will of the unseen. Now it's like, okay, Aeneas is just going to be the king. He's going to have land here. Why did we even fight him? Therefore, he called together his high council, line 320. Principal men of Latium in his court, and in all haste, they came to the royal house through the full streets. Eldest among them, first in power of the scepter, grim in aspect, King Latinus took his chair, commanding those returned from the Aetolian town to tell their tale, their answers point by point, silence being enjoined on all the rest. Obediently, Vinellius began. So he wants to tell me the story of going to Diomedes and how he turned you down. So everybody's really quiet, and now they tell the story. We've seen Diomedes, fellow townsmen, seen the Argive, the Greek camp. We made the journey, won through all the dangers, gripped the hand that brought down the realm of Ilium, Troy. We saw him laying the foundations of his city, named Argipia for his father's race, in Eryx country, hard by Mount Garganus. When we were in the camp with leave to speak before him, tendering our gifts, we told what name was ours, what fatherland, what enemy made war upon us, and what urgent cause drew us to Arpi. First he heard us out, and then he answered peacefully. Fortunate race, so this is Diomedes telling them, I'm not going to come do war for you. Fortunate race and realm of Saturn, men of old Ausonia, southern Italy, what happened to disturb your quiet life and make you rouse the unknown that is war? We who did violence to the Ilian, the Trojan land, with cold steel, and I now pass over pain endured in warfare under those high walls and soldiers of the Simois there holds under. All of us have paid throughout the world beyond belief in suffering for our crimes. Priam himself might pity the lot of us. So here we have Diomedes, a Greek, acting like, okay, we committed all these crimes and we've paid a high price. Remember that the Aeneid is told from the point of the Trojans, not from the Greeks. So we've all sinned and paid for our crimes, said Diomedes, the great Greek hero. Priam himself might pity the lot of us. Witness Minerva's deadly star and storm, Euboean Craig's vengeful decoying light, line 355. Then too, after our conquest, driven far to strange landfells, Menelaus Atrides tastes exile near the pillars of Proteus. Ulysses Odysseus has beheld Aetnean Cyclops. Neoptolemus, Achilles' son, realm, shall I tell of that? And hearth gods of Enomenius destroyed, of Locrians now displaced in Libya? So he's telling them, every one of our super great Greek heroes had something really bad happen to him. We were the sinners. We shouldn't have ever gone to Troy. Even that marshal of the great Achaeans, the Mycenaean, that means Agamemnon, entering his home, met death at his unspeakable consort's hands, at Clytemnestra, his wife, his consort's hands. The adulterer lay in wait at Asia's fall, for Troy's fall. And must I add, all that the gods denied me, returned to the altars of my fatherland, my longed-for wife, Caldon's loveliness, at this hour still, portents I dread to see pursue me, lost companions, turned to birds, have taken to the air and roam the streams. What torture for my soldiers as they fill the sea cliffs with their cries, their mewing cries. These punishments were all to be expected from that day when I so far lost my mind as to attack a being formed in heaven, like when I attacked somebody that was formed in heaven. Wounding, defiling Venus's hand. Remember back in the Iliad book 5, Diomedes went out to fight and he actually injured Aphrodite Venus, and he never should have done that. That was like really bad. No, invite me to no warfare such as this. Troy fallen, I have no quarrel with Trojans, no delight in calling up evil days. The gifts you bring me from your country, take instead to Aeneas. I've stood my ground against his whetted spear, fought him with swords. Trust one who knows the surging mass of him behind his shield, the whirlwind of his cast. So Virgil here is making Aeneas a major character in the Iliad, whereas he was barely mentioned, and he makes him here out to be another Hector or something, not like Diomedes. No, I wouldn't fight him again. Had Ida's land borne two more men like him, Troy would have marched upon the towers of Argos. Greece would be mourning a contrary fate. As to our stalemate before stubborn Troy, the sworn sword arm of Aeneas with Hector's halted dominance of the Greeks for 10 long years, both known for courage. So Diomedes told the story that it is Aeneas and Hector that kept off the Greeks all those 10 years. As I said, Virgil is rewriting this in the view of the Trojans. Both known for courage, both for skill in arms, Aeneas, first in reverence for the gods, he's very religious, your right hands and your forces should be joined as well may be. Take care they do not clash in combat. So this is the great Diomedes, and Virgil has him saying, don't go fight Aeneas, whatever you do. Now your majesty has heard both Diomedes' responses and his views of our great war, line 400. So his emissaries have come back and they just told the story. Barely had the legates, the representatives, finished their story when a hubbub arose, and turbulence among the listening faces. So there's a big hubbub. Oh my goodness, what's going on? What was it like? As when rock beds that stem a rushing stream make the recoiled current roar and banks re-echo from foam lash of the waves. But soon the council's mood grew calm, excited tongues were stilled, and calling on the gods from his high throne, the king spoke out. So King Latinus is speaking out. Much earlier than this I should have wished, and wiser it would have been to meet and take decisions in this crisis, not with the enemy at our walls, as now. My countrymen, we make ill-omened war with men of heavenly birth unconquerable. So we can't go to war with Aeneas. He's from heaven, Aphrodite's son. Unconquerable, untired by battle, and even in defeat, unable to put up the sword. What hope you had of brothers in arms, Aetolians, you must dismiss. Each man may have his hope, but this how narrow now you see. Then to all that we had, now visited with ruin, lies before your eyes and in your hands. But I accuse no one. What bravery could do was done. The whole strength of our kingdom, line 425, fought the battle. It is over. Now let me disclose the plan formed in my mind, still tentatively. Give me your attention. I shall be brief. There's an old domain of mine along the Tuscan stream, extending far toward sundown, well beyond Sicanian boundaries. Aruncians and Rutilians sow crops there, plow the stony hills, or graze the wildest of them. Let this region all be ceded now in friendship to the Trojans. Let's give all this land to the Trojans, with a pine-forested zone of mountain heights. Let's make equitable treaty terms. So let's make a treaty with them. And in the realm, call them co-citizens. Here let them settle and here build their walls, if such desire is in them. If their hearts are set on other lands and other races, and they are able to leave our soil, why then twice 10 good ships of stout Italian oak will build them. We'll build them 20 ships if they want to leave here. If they muster crews for more, the timber lies at the sea's edge. They may prescribe the number and rig, and we shall give the bronze, the labor, and the launching ways. If it will content me first, further, that 100 emissaries, chosen from our best, shall bring our terms and sign the pact and offer all of vows of peace. Line 450, carrying gifts, gold bars and ivory and throne and robe, insignia of our kinship. All take counsel here and now, shore up our tired strength. So the king just said, oh, we're going to give this up now, not fight it, it's from the gods. We're going to give him land if he wants to stay here. If he doesn't want to stay here, we'll build him a bunch of boats so he can go. Then Drances, remember this is the guy that hates Turnus. Then Drances rose, belligerent as before. The fame of Turnus galled him, made him smart with envy unconfessed. This wealthy man, a lavish spender and an orator, but a cold hand in battle, held to be no empty counselor, a strong party man. His mother's nobility made him arrogant, line 460, although he had no certain father. Now he spoke to add and to aggravate their anger. Excellency, it is all clear as day, the situation you address. No need for us to enlarge on it. All here concede. They know what these events mean for our people, yet they keep silent. Let the man we know allow us liberty to speak, and let him hold his bluster, his unlucky star, his baleful influence, and I shall say it, threaten as he may to run me through, his whim put out so many shining lights among our captains that we see our city founder in grief. Well, at the Trojan camp, he skirmishes, being sure to get away, frightening the air with javelins. One more gift, your gracious majesty. Include with all you'd have us send or offer to the Trojans, one more gift, and let no violence from any man prevail on you to yield a father's right. Betrothal of your daughter, fittingly, to an exceptional son. So this guy that hates Turnus, and of course Turnus wants to marry King Latinus' daughter, and he says, give him all those gifts, give all these things to Aeneas, tell him he can live here, and give him your daughter. It, fitting to an exceptional son. Aeneas, he's a great guy. By that eternal bond to accomplish peace. And that, many people have done this through the ages. You marry your son to their daughter, and that way you have peace. But if our minds and hearts are so oppressed by terror, let us plead with Turnus here himself to do this kindness to us all, resign his marital rights to king and country. Why must you, sir, send into open peril time and again your suffering countryman? You, chief of woes to Latium, cause of all. In war there's no salvation. We require peace of you, Turnus, and along with it the one pledge that makes peace inviolable. Look, I whom you pretend to be your rival, so you act like I'm not your friend, and of course he hates his guts. I will not linger on that. I, first of all, come to beg you, pity your own people. Cool your hot head. Being beaten, leave the field. In our defeat, we've seen enough of death, line 500, and made a landscape desolate. If glory is on your mind still, iron self-conceit, or a royal house for dowry charms you so, then take the risk and brave the enemy. Must I suppose that for the sake of Turnus's royal marriage, we poor common souls should strew the field unburied and unwept? Do we all have to die just so he can marry the girl he wants? Come, sir, if any fighting blood is in you, any native legacy from Mars, go face the man who calls you out to combat. Under this taunting, Turnus's fiery temper flared up, but he gave a groan of scorn and then broke out in his deep voice. So this is an angry, angry Turnus talking to the guy that hates him. Plenty of talk you always have when contests call for action. Summon a senate, you're the first one there. No need to fill this hall with words, big words you can let fly in safety, keeping walls between you and the enemy, no moats as yet running with blood. Hammer away with all your rhetoric. Say I'm afraid when your own sword has left the dead in heaps, the field brilliant with trophies everywhere. So go ahead, call me afraid. You've already killed a whole bunch of people. I haven't even got to kill anybody yet. You want me to just stop now? I didn't even get to kill a whole bunch of people. You've already got to leave the dead in heaps. The field brilliant with trophies everywhere. What bravery and action can achieve, you are still free to experience. No need to hunt for enemies. They ring the walls. Go out to meet them, shall we? Why hang back? With all your skill for battle, rest forever in a windbag's breath and in those flying feet? Beaten, am I? Can anyone have cause to utter that word? Beaten, you foul wretch. Seeing the Tiber risen with Ilian blood and all Evander's house, his line brought low, Acadians killed and stripped. I should not say I seem a beaten man to Bitias and Pandarus, that giant, or the throngs I sent to hell on one victorious day, shut between walls, at bat with enemy earthworks to right and left of me. In war, there is no salvation. So he's repeating his words. Sing that to your Trojan chief and to your own prospects, you mad fool. Go on confusing everything with fear. Exalt a race twice conquered and their strength. Cry down Latinus' power. Nowadays the Myrmidons tremble. So this is sarcasm. Nowadays the Myrmidons, Achilles' people, tremble at Phrygian spears. So nowadays Achilles' people tremble at the Trojans' spears. spears, which of course they never did, so this is sarcasm. Diomedes and Achilles tremble, yes, and often as torrent flows uphill, the river flows uphill, in flight from the Adriatic, the river flows uphill from the ocean. Take him now, pretending to be frightened when I blast him, the artful devil, just to add that touch, intimidation, to his case against me. You'll never lose that life, such as it is, to this right hand, don't worry. Let it stay long resident in that tame breast of yours. Now, Father, I revert to you, to your large-scale proposal. If you put no further hope in our fighting power, if we are left so unsupported, if our army corps but one reversal has gone all to pieces, our fortune reached the point of no return, then let us beg for peace with beggar's hands. Yet, oh, had we a spark of our old spirit, the luckiest of men in this hard time, the finest man, to my mind, would be he who bit the dust once and for all and died to avoid a sight like this. So lucky guy died before he had to see what's come of us, that we are begging to not go fight and get glory. But if, in fact, we have resources, fresh reserves of men, Italian states, and peoples with us still, line 570, and if the Trojans won at a great cost in blood, they have their burials as well, the storm struck all alike, why then give up like cowards on the threshold? Why allow our knees to shake before a trumpet blows? Days passing and the changing work of time have often righted things. Fortune returns to put on solid ground those she derided. Say the Aetolian will not help, nor the Arpi. Messapus will, so will that lucky seer, Tolumnius, so will chiefs, whom many nations send to us, and no small fame will come to the picked men of Latium and Laurentum. Yes, and Camilla of the noble Volsci, leading her cavalry splendid in bronze. But if the Trojans call on me alone, line 585, so he's saying we should all go out and get more glory. But if the Trojans call on me alone for combat, and if you approve, and I am blocking something for the good of all, then victory has not so bitterly hated these hands and so eluded them that I should not, in such a hopeful cause, make my attempt, and cheerfully I'll go against him, though he overshadow Achilles, and wear gear made like his by Vulcan's hands. Sure, I'll go fight alone and fight him single hand-to-hand combat, even if he does have awesome armor made by Hephi. This life of mine, I, Turnus, not outdone in valor by the men of old, have sworn in service to my father-in-law and you. Aeneas calls on him alone. Call on, I pray, if this brings anger of the gods, may Drances, the guy that hates him, not appease it with his death, nor if it brings honor and feats of arms, may he bear off the palm for these. The two debated the obscure future in this way in bitter strife. Line 605. Meanwhile, Aeneas left camp and took the field. So now we're back to Aeneas's people. He left camp and took the field. Now see a messenger hastening through the palace with hue and cry to alarm the town. He brought word that the Trojan battle line and the Tuscan complement had left the Tiber to move down the plain. Their minds in tumult, shaken by the news, the common people felt their anger roused as by a goad. With oaths their hands went out for arms, and then the young men yelled, "To arms!" even as their despondent fathers wept. So all the fathers said, "Let's quit the war, let's give him gifts and let him live here." And all the young guys are like, "Let's go fight." Fathers wept. Everywhere now clamor and discord arose, line 615, into the air above the town. What was this all like? As when bird flocks come down in a tall grove, or swans where the Pedusan channel teems with fish give their hoarse-throated cries on echoing pools. But Turnus caught the moment and made it his. He said, "Just so, my townsmen, hold your council, sit and praise the name of peace, and they, their army sweeps to attack our capital. Oh, hold on, you guys, I thought you wanted to sit around in peace while they're attacking our capital." That was all. He leapt up and away, quitting the council hall with rapid stride, then gave commands. "Volusus, it's for you to make the Volscian squadrons arm. You lead the Rutulians. Messapus, arm your horsemen. Chorus, you and your twin brother see our cavalry deployed across the plain. 1 foot battalion reinforced the approach to the city and man the towers. All the rest, prepare with me for action as and where I order." Line 636, running crowds made for the city walls, and King Latinus, prey to the dark hour, left the council chamber and postponed all he had set afoot. Bitterly now he blamed himself for having failed to welcome Aeneas, the Dardanian, to his realm as son-in-law. So now King Latinus just wishes he would have said, "Yeah, be my son-in-law," and had a wedding instead of a war. Before the city gates, deep pits were dug, big stones and pikes brought up, as vibrant trumpets sang bloodshed and war. In long, uneven lines, mothers and boys appeared atop the ring of walls. The final effort drew them all. The queen as well rode in her carriage with a company of mothers to the shrine of Pallas, high above the town, with gifts, so up to Athena, Pallas Athena, to give her gifts and ask her favor in war. And close beside her, the young princess Lavinia rode, the cause of so much suffering, lovely eyes downcast, the women entering beclouded out at all that shrine with smoke of incense and sad voices rode from the portal in a tide of prayer. So they're all praying to Athena, the goddess of war. O power over battle, our protectress, Virgin Tritonia, that's Athena, Virgin Athena, whom here they call Minerva, shatter in thy hand the spear shaft of the Phrygian corsair of the Trojan pirate. Throw him headlong to earth, let him lie dead below our high gates. So he's calling Aeneas a Trojan pirate. Turnus, furiously on edge for battle, pulled his armor on, first his cuirass, glowing red, so his chest armor, glowing red with scales aquiver, then he encased his legs in gold, his head still bare, he belted on his sword, and ran down from the citadel, his figure glittering, golden, while his heart beat high, at grips with foemen, his enemies, even now in thought. And what was it like as he did all this? Line 670, as a stallion breaks his tether, and goes free at last out of the stall, and down the meadow, gaining the open land. There he may turn to a grazing herd of mares, or canter on to a stream he knows well for a cooling plunge, neighing and frisking, tossing back his head, his mane at play over his neck and shoulders. That's what he was like. Square in his path, her Volscian squads behind her, Camilla came. Okay, Camilla is favored by Artemis Diana. Camilla is a female warrior. Camilla came, hard-riding warrior queen. Before the gates, she leapt down from her mount, and her whole troop, taking the cue, dismounted, at the same instant slipping to the earth. She spoke then, saying, Turnus, as confidence goes hand in hand with bravery that earned it, now I dare and undertake to meet Aeneas' horsemen, charging the Tuscan cavalry alone. Let me first risk the combat at close quarters. You, with your infantry, stand by the walls meanwhile and guard the city. His eyes intent upon the awesome virgin, what a name for Camilla, she's an awesome virgin, Turnus answered, Virgin, glory of Italy, how tell my gratitude, or how repay my debt? Courageous spirit, towering above all here, now share the toil with me. Rumor confirmed by scouts I send informs me that the dog Aeneas dispatched his light-armed horse ahead to scour the plain, while on the mountain track through the wild land, crossing the ridge, he makes his own descent upon the town. I'll set an ambush where the path is arched by forest, soldiers to close both ends of the defile. You take the field, engage the Tuscan horse, Messapus and the Latin cavalry will be there with you, and Tibertus's troop. Plan your battle as my co-commander. With corresponding orders, he dispatched Messapus with his Latins to that fight while he himself marched on his enemy. Line 710. The battle road curves in a pass designed by nature for entrapment and surprise, heavily wooded, dark on either hand. The road thins out here, and the narrowing gorge begrudges a way through. But on high ground, amid the lookout posts, along the crest, there's a concealed plateau, a safe retreat, whether you plan a rush from right or left, or stand fast on the ridge and roll down boulders. Here, by familiar shortcuts, Turnus came, preempted the high ground, and lay in wait in woods made dangerous. In heaven, meanwhile, back up on Mount Olympus, in heaven, meanwhile, Diana, Artemis, spoke to Opis, the fleet huntress, so one of her women. So Diana has a servant woman up in Olympus, Opis. The fleet huntress, one of the divine virgins in her train, her lips opened in sadness, and she said, Sister, now Camilla goes her way to the cruel war, equipped with bow and quiver, weapons of ours, but all in vain. Cherish her as I may beyond the rest. No new love this come just now to Diana, moving my heart with pleasure. Years ago, and now this Opis is going to tell the story of Camilla, because she feels terrible that Camilla is fated to die, because she's coming all in vain. So she tells the story of Camilla. Years ago, when haters of his insolent power drove him out of Privernum, ancient realm and town, Metabus took along his infant child, that'd be Camilla, in flight amid the struggles of that war to share his exile. By her mother's name, Casmilla, changed a bit, he called the child Camilla. Now he carried her before him close to his breast, and toiled for refuge on long ridges in the wilderness, though spears of grim pursuit were everywhere behind, and Volscian patrols cast a wide net. Lo and behold, square in his path, in flood, the torrent Amazimus, foaming high, ran over banks and brim, filled by so wild a cloudburst. So the poor guy can't even get across the river because it's swollen right now. As the man prepared to swim it, love for his infant stayed him, and he feared for his dear burden. Weighing all the choices possible, he settled suddenly and desperately on this. In his tough hand, he chanced to carry a battle spear of oak, knotted and seasoned. Now to this he tied his child, encased in cork tree bark, and bound her trimly in the middle of the shaft. He just tied his baby daughter to a spear. He balanced it in his big hand and prayed to the heir of heaven, "Daughter of Latona, Diana, kindly virgin of the groves, I, her father, swear this child shall be thy servant. The first weapon she embraces, thine, as by thy mercy through the air she escapes the enemy. I beg thee, goddess, take her as thine own, this girl committed now to the veering wind." Line 766. Then he drew back his arm and let the spun shaft fly. The waters dinned below and over the rushing stream. Small and forlorn, Camilla soared across upon the whistling spear shaft, well aware of troops in force approaching from behind. Metabus took to the river. Spear and child in triumph, he recovered from the turf his offering to the Virgin of the Crossroads, which would be offering or Diana. So he threw the spear across. The baby makes it on the spear. You can imagine what experience that was. And he got across swimming. Not a city gave him sanctuary, public or private, nor would he himself, because of his fierce nature, yield to any. So he lived out his life upon the shepherd's lonely mountains. Here, in undergrowth, amid rough haunts of beasts, he nursed his daughter, putting her to the breast of a wild mare, whose teats he milked into her tender mouth. He's milking a wild horse to get the baby milk. When the small child took her first steps, he armed her hands with a sharp javelin and hung a bow and quiver from her infant shoulder. It's just what he promised Diana he would do. Line 786. No gold headband, no flowing outer garment covered her, but a tiger skin hung down her back from head to foot, and as a child, she flung play darts with her soft hand and whirled a sling stone on a strap around her head, a slingshot, to fell a crane or a styrmion or a swan. Then many mothers in the Tuscan towns desired her in vain to be their daughter. They all wanted their sons to marry her. All her contentment being with Diana, the girl remained untouched and ever cherished passion for arms and for virginity. I wish that she had not been swept away in this campaign or tried to challenge Trojans. She would still, be still my dear, one of my sisters. Come, though, granted harsh fate is at hand, she's going to die. Go gliding out of heaven, nymph, and visit Latin lands where, with unlucky omen, battle is begun. Here are my weapons. Take one vengeful shaft out of the quiver. By this, let any Trojan or Italian, one or the other, who may violate her sacred body with a wound, pay back in blood an equal penalty to me. So Diana gives Otis one arrow and says, if anyone hurts, whoever hurts Camilla, you shoot him back. Then I shall carry, pillowed in a cloud, the body of the pitiable one. That's Camilla. They're already foreseeing her death. Her war gear intact, to find her final rest in her own land and tomb. When she had finished, Opus, Diana's attendant, dropped from heaven through light airs with a rushing sound, wrapped in a dark whirlwind. The Trojan column now approached the town with Tuscan chiefs and with all their cavalry and numbered squadrons. Over the level ground with thudding hooves, the war horse trots and snorts and rears up, line 820, tugging at the cheek's check of rein and curvets here and there. The wide steel glinting field bristles with lances. The long vista teems with upright arms. Against them soon Messapus and the headlong Latin horse, Corsus his brother and Camilla's wing, came into view, defenders in the field, with lances drawn back, then in forward thrusts, and with a brandishing of javelins, the onward rush of men and horses neighing blazed in the sunlight. When they came within spear throw of one another, Trojan and Latin pulled up in a halt. Then all at once, with shouts, they spurred their furious mounts and flung their javelins in showers from both sides as thick as snowflakes, line 835, making a daytime dusk. So they made the daylight look like it was almost dusk, because of all the spears all over the air. Now, shaft to shaft, Tyrrhenius and the savage Latin horseman Aconteus, bunch of names that I don't know who they are, met head-on with a mighty crash that caused the first downfall from shock of horses, breast to bursting breast. So the horses whammed each other and the riders fell off. Aconteus, pitched off like a thunderbolt or stone out of a catapult, came down far off, his life dispersed into the air. So he just died when he fell off his horse. At this, their lines disordered, Latin troopers turned and, tossing shields behind their shoulders, rode off toward the town. Acilus led the Trojan squadrons in pursuit, but then, when near the walls, again the Latins yanked their horses, yielding necks about, and wheeled to fight. Now Trojans fled in turn at a full gallop, as in full retreat. And what was it like? Just as the sea, with alternating rush, now runs ashore in foam above the ledges and lapping soaks the sand high on the beach, now in a rapid seeding ebb recedes and glides from land and pulls the rolling pebbles. So they ran, and then they turned around and went back. Twice the Tuscans drove the Rutulians headlong to the walls, but thrown back twice they fled, glancing behind, their shoulders covered. Now, when they came together a third time, line 860, the two formations mingled, man to man, and then indeed groans of the dying rose, then arms and bodies in a mire of blood went down, and dying horses with their riders butchered as the bitter fight surged on. Orsilochus, in dread of meeting Remulus, hurled his javelin at the other's mount and left the steel point in it under its ear. At this the war horse reared in fury, four legs high, to shake the wound away with towering chest, and Remulus was thrown to earth. Catulus brought down Ilolus, then Herminius, great-souled, great-bodied warrior, his bare head flowing with tawny locks, his shoulders bare, wounds held no terrors for him, great as he was, fighting uncovered, but the driven lance a quiver passed clean through his shoulder's breadth and made him double up in agony. Dark blood spilt everywhere. Men dealt out death by cold steel as they fought and strove by wounds to win the beauty of courageous death. Amid the carnage, like an Amazon, Camilla rode exultant. So Camilla is compared to an Amazon. One breast bared for fighting ease, her quiver at her back. At times she flung slim javelins, thick and fast, at times tireless, caught up her two-edged axe. The golden bow, Diana's weapon, rang upon her shoulders. Yes, when she gave ground, forced to retreat with bow unslung in flight, she turned and aimed her arrows. At her side rode chosen comrades, virgins all, Lorena, Tula, Tarpeia, shaking her bronze axe. These were the girls of Italy that she, divine Camilla, picked to be her pride, her staunch handmaidens, both in peace and war. So ride the hardened Amazons of Thrace, with drumming hooves on frozen Thermodon, warring in winter in their painted gear, sometimes around Hippolyta, the chieftain, or when the daughter of Mars, Penthesilea, drives her chariot back victorious, and woman warriors bearing crescent shields exult, riding in tumult with wild cries. Savage girl, whom did your lance unhorse? What victims first and last? How many thrown down on the battlefield? Line 905. Torn bodies dying. Eunaeus, Clytius, the sun came first. He faced her with unarmored breast, and with her shaft of pine she ran him through. He tumbled, coughing streams of blood, took bites of bloody earth, and dying writhed on his wound. Then she brought Lyrus down, then Pegasus. Lyrus, his mount, stabbed under him, spun off and tried to gather up the reins. Pegasus, coming to help, put out his hand, unarmed, and both alike went down. She sent to join them Hippotas's son, Amastris. At a distance, pressing down with couched lance, she rode after Teus, Hippocalus, Demophoon, and Chromis, and for every javelin she twirled and cast a Phrygian trooper fell. Still out of range, Ortinius, a hunter, rode an Iapygian horse in strange war gear, his broad shoulders covered by bullock's hide, his head by a huge wolf's muzzle gaping wide, with gleaming fangs. In his right hand he held a forester's blade, hunting spear. This man now wheeled about, the tallest by a head amidst his company, but soon Camilla caught him from behind. No effort there, since all were in retreat, and ran him through. Then from above, heart full of hate, she said, to this Camilla boasting, "In forests were you, Tuscan, flushing game? So you've run away to the forest. Oh, were you out looking to hunt, flushing your game out? The day has come when boasts of all your kind are proven wrong by women under arms. You'll take no light fame to your father's shades. You've been killed by the lance head of Camilla." She killed next two of the very tallest Trojans, Orsilochus and Butes. Butes' head being turned, she put her lance head in the gap between his helm and cuirass, where the neck showed white above the shield on the left arm. Then, running as Orsilochus, gave chase in a wide circuit, tricking him, she closed a narrowing ring till she became pursuer. Then, to her full height, risen, drove her axe repeatedly through helmet and through bone, as the man begged and begged her to show mercy. Warm brains from his head wound wetted his face. From his head wound wetted his face. One who came upon her at that moment reined in, taken aback at the sudden sight, the son of Aunus, Apennine Mountain. Not the least guileful of the Ligurians, this man was, while fate allowed him guile. He was sneaky. Seeing he could not spur away from combat, could not deflect the queen from her attack, resorting to a cunning ruse, he said, "What's so remarkable if, to a girl's taste, your mainstay is your horse? No running away. Take me on hand to hand on level ground, not on your horse. Get ready for a fight on foot and learn who's blown up. Vanity will have a fall." Now bitter anger made her burn at this. She gave a friend her mount and faced the man fearlessly, on foot, with equal arms, a naked blade, a shield without device. But he, who thought his ruse had worked, rode off without a pause, reining his mount around. So he didn't get off his horse. Now he runs off, reining his mount around, goading him into a run with iron spurs. So he tricked her to get her off her horse. Ligurian fool, too cocksure, much too soon. Your slippery native trickery has failed. No chance it will return you in your skin to honest the old deceiver to your dad. So the girl called out as in a sprint, with lightning pace. She came abreast and passed the running horse, then whirled and yanked the reins and met the shock of the Ligurian's onset, making him pay her penalty in hated blood. What was it like? So easily a falcon, sacred bird, from his rock tower will strike a soaring dove high in a cloud and grip her as he tears her viscera with crooked talons, blood and pulled out feathers fall from the sky. But on that scene, the father of gods and men kept no indifferent watch from his aerial seat high in Olympus. Zeus is watching. He roused the Tuscan Tarchon to the melee, instilling anger in him far from mild, so that amid the carnage where the companies of horse were giving way, Tarchon rode out with one shout or another, rallying the left and right wings, calling men by name, putting new fight in routed cavalry. Incapable of shame! Poltrons forever! Cowards forever! Tuscans, what is this fright? What cowardice has entered into you? Shall a single woman drive you out of line, break your formations? What do we carry swords for? Why hold on to useless lances? None of you is tame when it comes to making love. Bed wars at night are when a flute preludes the dance of Bacchus, when you're at a feast drinking. Look for a feast and cups on laden tables. All you care for, all you're keen for. Yes, when some dependable reader of the entrails, a seer or a prophet, heralds an offering and a fatted lamb, is calling you into the sacred wood. He's using sarcasm, saying, are you running off into a sacred wood to make sacrifices because of running off? With this he gave rein to his mount, prepared to face death, he as well, in the battle's heart, and straight for Venalus went storming on. With his right arm he swept him from the saddle, line 1011, hugged him to his chest, and spurring hard with a great effort, lugged the man away. A yell went up to heaven as all the Latins turned to watch, and like a streak of lightning, Tarchon with his load of man and weapons flew over open ground. Then he broke off the steel point of the enemy lance and groped for an opening where he could wound and kill him, but fighting back the other, warded off the hand aimed at his throat, met force with force. What was it like? As when a golden eagle, flapping skyward, bears a snake as prey, her feet entwined but holding fast with talons, while the victim, wounded as it is, coils and uncoils and lifts cold grisly scales and towers up with hissing maw, but all the same the eagle strikes the wrestler snake with crooked beak. That's what it was like. While beating her with her wings, the heir of heaven, just so, out of the Latin squadron, Tarchon triumphantly bore off his prey. And Tuscans, heeding the example of their captain gave, his daring that came off, at once attacked. So he gave the Tuscans new energy. One Aruns, a man marked by fate. So here's some foreboding, and the guy's name is Aruns, a man marked by fate, rode wide around Camilla, javelin at the ready, waiting his chance ahead of her in cunning. Wherever in the melee the girl rode in her wild forays, Aruns kept behind, silently stalking her. When she turned back, blooded from the enemy, he drew rein in stealth and swung his nimble mount away. Now this, looking for an opening, now that, he shadowed her, going about a circuit on all sides, the dangerous man, a dead shot, hefting clear his pointed shaft. By chance, line 1045, by chance Chlorius, Mount Sibyllus's votary, once a priest, came shining from far off in Phrygian gear. He spurred a foaming mount in a saddlecloth of hide, with scales of bronze as thick as plumage, interlinked with gold. The man himself, splendid in rust and purple, out of the strange east, drew a Lycian bow to shoot Gortinian arrows. At his shoulder golden was the bow, and golden too the helmet of the seer, and tawny gold that brooch that pinned his cloak as it belled out and snapped in the wind. A clammy crocus yellow tunic and trousers too, both eastern style, were brilliant with embroidery. Camilla began to track this man, her heart's desire either to fit luxurious Trojan gear on a temple door, so to In other words, she likes his outfit. So she's either thinking to put it on a temple door, it'll make a great offering, or maybe she could wear it. Or else herself to flaunt that golden plunder, blindly as a huntress following him and him alone, of all who took part in the battle she rode on, through a whole scattered squadron, recklessly, in a girl's love of finery. Now at length, from where he lurked, seeing the time had come, Aaron's went into action. Let his javelin come alive and prayed aloud to heaven, Supreme God, Holy Soracte's guardian, above all others we are blessed in thee, for whom the pine chip's glowing pile is fed, assured by our devotion in thy cult, we step through beds of embers without arms. Line 107.5. So apparently they walk on coals for him. Mighty Apollo, grant that we wipe out with arms this ignominy. I want no spoils, this shame, wipe out this shame. I want no spoils, no trophy of a beaten girl. My actions elsewhere will bring me honor. May this dire scourge of battle perish when hit by me. Then to the cities of my ancestors with no pretense of glory I'll return. Phoebus, Apollo heard and felt disposed to grant his prayer in part. The rest he gave the winds to blow away. Granted, Aaron's should fell Camilla in the shock of death. So that part was granted. Denied that Aaron's land should see the man return. Remember, just like Achilles, just like the prayer that he would, Achilles' prayer part was that Patroclus would go and do glorious things and then would come back, and only the part that he would go and do glorious things would work, but he wouldn't be granted to come back. This guy's not granted that he would come back. That plea to gale winds wafted to the south. So when the javelin whistled from his hand, the Volscians, to a man fiercely intent, looked toward their queen. Oblivious of the air around her, of the whistling shaft, the weapon gliding from high heaven, she remained until the javelin swooped and thudded home beneath her naked breast. Line 109.5. There, driven deep, the shaft drank the girl's blood. In consternation, fellow troopers gathered on the run to catch and hold their captain as she dropped. But Aaron's on the instant galloped off in a daze, in fearful joy. He runs fast to get away. He put no further trust in his lance nor in himself to meet the warrior girl in arms. So even though she's wounded, what was it like when he ran away? Just as a wolf who killed a shepherd or a full-grown steer makes off cross-country for the hills to hide before the arrows chase him, knowing well his keel was reckless, tail curved down between his legs, to his quaking belly off he goes. Just so, Aaron's in panic made himself scarce, well out of it amid a crowd of horsemen. Dying Camilla, line 1110. Dying Camilla tugged at the javelin, but the steel point between the ribs held fast in the deep wound. She drooped from loss of blood, her eyelids drooped, chill with approaching death, and the fresh glow of youth drained from her cheeks. With halting breath, she whispered now to Acca, one of her company, equally young, her confidant, most faithful of them all, and said, I'm dying. Until now, sister, I was able. Now this wound galls me and finishes me. Everything around is growing dark. Make your escape, and take my last command to Turnus, that he joined the battle here to keep the Trojans from the town. Farewell. Even while speaking, she let slip the reins and slid fainting to earth, little by little growing cold. The girl detached herself from her whole body and put down her head, death's captive now, upon her strengthless neck, and let her weapons fall. Then with a groan for that indignity, her spirit fled into the gloom below. She's dead. Now spreading measureless, a shout went up to strike the golden stars. Camilla gone! The fight became more savage. Massed for battle, Trojan in all their force pressed on, with Tuscan captains and the Arcadians of Evander. As to the sentinel of Diana, Opus, resting all this time on a mountaintop, remember Diana left her a spare arrow? She had been watching without fear, but now she sighted far off in the furious din of Calvary's, Camilla beaten down and pitifully dead. Then from her heart the nymph said, groaning, It is too cruel, girl, line 1145, your punishment, too cruel for having tried to challenge Trojans in the war. Devotion paid to Diana in your solitude, in the wild wood, our arrows on your shoulder, did not avail you. Yet your queen has left you not without honor at the hour of death, nor will your end be unrenowned among earth's people, nor will it be known as unavenged. Whoever dared to pierce your body impiously pays with his life, and justly. So Diana's servant Opus is going to go take revenge. On a mound in a mountain's shade, the ancient king Dersinus of Laurentium had an ilex darkened massive tomb, holly darkened massive tomb. Here with an easy spring most beautiful, the goddess mounted and looked down on Aaron's seeing him bright in arms and puffed with pride. "Why turn aside?" she said. "Step this way. Come and perish here. Enjoy the fit reward Camilla brings. You wretch! Will even you die? Will even you die by Diana's arrows?" She then picked a feathered shaft out of the golded quiver, and taking deadly aim, drew the bow back full circle, 1170, till the tip could almost meet. Her hands aligned, the left hand felt the point, the right hand in taut bowstring touched her breast. All in one instant, Aarons heard the arrow, whilst in the ripped air, and the arrowhead thud in his body. He heard it, and it hit his body instantly. As he moaned and died, his fellow troopers rode off unaware and left him in the dust, a spot unknown on the wide terrain. Opus, taking wing, went soaring to the high Olympian air. Now first to leave the field, their mistress lost, were Camilla's light-armed cavalry. Then routed Rutulians made off, and fierce Atinas, captains torn from squadrons, troops astray, wheeled toward the town and looked for safety there. No one at all could hold or make a stand with javelins against the Trojan onset. Bows were unstrung on slumping shoulders. Galloping hooves shook up the loose, dry mire of the field. A dusky cloud of churned-up dust rolled onto the city walls. Line 1190, where mothers on the towers with beaten breasts lifted their woman's cry to the stars of heaven. Hard on the heels of men first breaking through the open gates, a crowd of enemy pressed, of men on both sides mingled. So there was no escape from piteous death, but in the very entry, amid the walls of their own city, their protecting houses lanced from behind, they gave up life and breath. Then after some had shut the gates they dared not open a way in for their friends. So they got back to their city, and the people shut the gates, and now they have to die outside their own city. They dared not open a way in for their own friends, or take them into the town, beg as they would. Now came a wretched slaughter, as the gate's defenders shot at that crowd that rushed upon their shots, kept out before the eyes of weeping parents. Some of those borne onward in the rout plunged headlong in the moat, and others rode in blind panic to batter at the gates, unyielding, barred against them. You know, let us in, let us in. On the walls, even older women, mothers, as true love of homeland taught them, and as they had seen Camilla fight, outdid each other now at hurling missiles with unsteady hands, in place of steel, hard oaken box and pikes with fire-hardened points. For their town wall they dared, they burned, to be the first to die. So even the women are fighting from the wall. In the mountain wood, meanwhile, the cruel news filled Turnus's thoughts as Acca brought him word of the great tumult. Volscan troops destroyed, Camilla fallen, foes in Mars' good graces carrying all before them, riding on, panic already at the city's walls, raging, as Jove's hard will required. So Jove made Turnus furiously enraged. Turnus left the heights that he had manned and left the rough wood. Hardly was he out of sight, line 1225, hardly was he out of sight and holding level ground, when Lord Aeneas entered the pass, unguarded now, and crossed the ridge, and issued from the woodland shade. Then both, with no time lost, marched on the city, two whole hosts, not many miles apart. Aeneas viewed the plain smoking with dust far off, and saw the army of Laurentum. Turnus at the same time recognized Aeneas, pitiless captain in the field, and heard the tramp of feet, the neigh of horses coming behind. In moments, so they're riding in parallel lines headed for the city. In moments they would skirmish, go to the test of battle. Had not reddened Phoebus, Apollo already dipped his weary team in the Spanish Sea. So Phoebus is making his team of horses go down. He's taking the sun down at sunset. As the bright day ebbed, brought on by the night, one army strengthened walls, the other encamped in quiet before the town.